In 1914, suffragettes Louisa Garrett Anderson and Flora Murray found themselves at a pivotal crossroads. Despite being fully trained doctors, they were barred from working in mainstream hospitals. In her book, No Man's Land, author Wendy Moore chronicles the dangerous struggle these two matriarchs of medicine faced as World War I pressed down upon London. At great personal cost, Anderson and Murray seized that moment in history, determined to open England's very first hospital run exclusively by women. Just like the right to vote, the effort faced significant opposition.
It made me really think quite hard about the fact that I obviously take the vote for granted, like most women do today. But would I have gone to those lengths? Would I have smashed windows and gone to prison? It really made me think quite hard about commitment and campaigning and what we're prepared to do for our beliefs.
This is Your Life Depends on It, a Media Fabrica podcast, co-hosted by Dr. David Schneider and Mark Steele.
What are you willing to suffer for your convictions? For many around the world, the fight against tyranny and oppression is still an everyday reality. For reasons as varied as race, religion, or sexual orientation, millions face a painful uphill battle just to obtain equal standing. In England of World War I, Louisa Garrett Anderson and Flora Murray faced such opposition. Due only to their gender, they found their medical education floundering, as women were not legally allowed to treat men. Suffragettes were already mounting an uphill battle for the right to vote, and now, this astute surgeon and anesthesiologist found themselves incapable of practicing their own expertise. Author Wendy Moore tells the uplifting and harrowing tale of Anderson and Murray in her book, No Man's Land. In so doing, she challenged her own thought processes and reevaluated her conviction for the causes in which she believes. As you listen, seriously consider your position in this world and your role in either the oppression or opportunities you offer to those unlike you. Are you part of the solution that will make this world a place where all can thrive and reveal their expertise? Or is your prejudice part of the problem?
Joining Dave today is English journalist, historian, and author Wendy Moore. Her written works include Endell Street, The Trailblazing Women Who Ran World War I's Most Remarkable Military Hospital, which tells the story of the suffragette doctors Louisa Garrett Anderson and Flora Murray, who set up and ran the Endell Street Military Hospital in the heart of London in World War I. It is published by Atlantic Books in the United Kingdom and with the alternate title No Man's Land by Basic Books in the United States.
Her writing has appeared in The Times, The Guardian, The Observer, and The Sunday Telegraph. She has won the 2005 Medical Journalist Association Open Book Award, and she lives in London with her family. We are delighted to welcome author Wendy Moore. Welcome, Wendy.
Hi there. Good to be with you.
First off, we love to delve into origin stories here at Your Life Depends on It. So what is the Wendy Moore origin story? What made you into the writer and investigator of history that you are?
Okay, that's an interesting question. Well, I started out as a journalist, so my training's in journalism, but I've always been interested in history. And because most of my journalism has been about the medical world, I've combined the two together. I did a diploma in the history of medicine, and from that sprang my first book. So my first book was about an 18th century surgeon, John Hunter. And you could say the rest is history because I carried on. I've written five books now in total. So they're all about social or medical history. They're all nonfiction, so they're completely factual. But I try to tell them for a popular audience so that they're novelistic in style as well.
Was there a moment you can recall in your childhood when you kind of knew, oh, I want to investigate things. I want to be a journalist. I want to write. What formed that as a young person?
I had no interest in journalism as a child at all, but I grew up with books. My dad took me to the library every Saturday. We got four books. I read voraciously. So I grew up not deciding to want to be a writer, but just not understanding anything else. So that's always what I imagined I would do. And then I went into journalism because I discovered at school there was no career path to become a writer. So I studied journalism, trained as a journalist, as a kind of route into writing. And then I had a very long detour before I got to really what I'd always wanted to do, which is writing books.
In secondary school, did you have much training in science and were you exposed to healthcare issues?
Well, it's interesting because both my parents really have a sort of scientific background. My dad worked as an industrial chemist. My mother worked in a laboratory until she had children. But I was absolutely hopeless at science. I really struggled with all the scientific subjects. I scraped a low grade in chemistry and biology, gave up physics. So really had no inclination towards science at all. So again, I came at it through a roundabout way because I started writing about medical care. And I became interested in medical history. And I think that's partly because of all the incredible stories there are in medical history, but also because it's such a peculiar story in that so much of medical history was completely useless. Most of what they did was completely ineffectual until pretty much the beginning of the 20th century.
Well, I'd have to say it's both surprising and sounds like a gift that you didn't feel like you came to science naturally, because it's surprising to me because you do such a great job of conveying that in your books, and particularly in this most recent book, No Man's Land, or on the stateside, No Man's Land. But I think it may be the fact that you don't naturally feel like you come by it, that you delve deeply into it and have such a great way of then transferring that information to us. Does it feel like it's a slog to go through it and really understand it so that you can communicate it?
Well, I suppose in some ways I have an advantage in that I don't know very much to start out with, so I can ask the stupid questions.
Right.
And I frequently go to experts, you know, doctors in the field, or other people with expertise to ask them these questions. And I've been, you know, very lucky that lots of doctors, historians and other experts have always very generously helped me. And I think my training as a journalist just basically gave me that curiosity to find a story and then tell it in a way that's as simple and clear as possible. So really that's what I aim to do.
So you've cited The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe as your biggest literary influence on you as a child. Tell us about your love for C.S. Lewis and how that influences the way that you write now.
Right, that's a left field question, isn't it?
We love left field questions. Right.
Well, it goes back to what I said before. I loved stories. The more fantastical, the better, really. Mm. That story, I think, appealed to me. It was the first book I ever actually owned because we didn't really have many books in the house. We went to the library. It was the first book I chose for myself, and I was bewitched by the whole story. And yeah, really, it is just these remarkable stories that captivate me. And that is true as well of medical history. Mm. There are just some remarkable stories and remarkable characters too.
You know, I've often heard it debated that children who are drawn to The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, for the most part, grow into adults who attempt to build a better world, because it is that dynamic of the book that appeals to them as young people, stepping out of one world into a world where things have changed, and those people become change makers. Have you found that true of your perspective, that as you, especially as a chronicler of history, that you are paving everything from warnings of what we've done wrong to respect for what we've done right so that people would change what's going on in the world today?
I've not heard that theory, but I think what I've felt about the book, you know, looking back on it now, I wasn't really aware of it at the time, is it's really a story about good versus evil, about social responsibility versus cruelty and greed. And I suppose I did grow up with that very strong sense in my mind of what was right and what was wrong. Mm. And I think I probably still feel that very much today. Yeah.
You mentioned as a detail when you were talking about your visits to the library with your dad that you would always get four books. I love that detail because I grew up in the same manner, and that limit of you have to choose, you have to narrow it down, created such a love for written language because there was something it elevated in me of, I'm limited. I can only take with me so many stories, so I'd better find the right stories.
Yeah, absolutely. I had kind of palpitations thinking about which four books I would choose. Four was the maximum. So that's all I was allowed to take. And so I'd choose long books so they'd last me longer. But there were times when I'd read all those books before the end of the week and I had to start rereading some of them. So, yeah, I just kind of tore through my books, really.
Knowing how much your family esteemed books, what was it like when you got your first copy of the first book you wrote? And what was that like then, giving that to your parents? What was that moment like?
It's interesting, really, because there's such a long process between having finished writing a book and the book arriving in your hands. And by that point, I will have read my text 20 or 30 times.
Right.
So in some ways, it's always a bit of an anticlimax, actually, receiving the book.
So true.
And you think, oh, so that was what it was all about, really.
Right.
So,
there is a romantic ideal you get in your head of that moment. You're going to hand the book off, and then at the end, it is like, oh, yeah, I guess we did that.
Yes, yeah. I think usually by that point, I'm onto another book as well. So that's kind of in my head. But yeah, I mean, I've got my books displayed in my room and I'm very proud of them. And my second book, which is called Wedlock, is not a medical history story. It's about a social history.
Right.
But that's the one I dedicated to my parents. And so my parents were very pleased with that. Yeah.
Oh, I can only imagine turning the page and then seeing that, because as a parent, you're always thinking about your kid, both as an adult and interacting with them. But then you have these little flashback moments to the little girl in the library. I'm sure your parents must have had a moment like that thinking, and now our names are here in this book by our daughter.
Well, I've dedicated them to my children as well. So I'm very glad to say my children have read the books even. So yeah,
right.
That's nice.
I want to just delve for a moment into the fact that you were a reporter, that you did start off as a journalist, not just a novelist, and the fact that you were a crime reporter for a season. Were there some crimes that you investigated that really impacted you and or scared you or informed who you are today?
Well, I really enjoyed being a police reporter, a crime reporter. That was my first job in journalism. You know, it was exciting. You felt like you were right in the thick of things.
Was this in London?
Initially, it was in the countryside or in, you know, a market town. And then I came to London. So it was really exciting, you know, being sometimes taken out in a police car. I went out in a police car all night for one expedition. You know, I'd go to the police station frequently and be taken in by the detectives. And it was, you know, it was thrilling. There was a lot of, you know, it was the 80s, so they weren't all behaving properly at that time.
I can imagine.
Yeah, not at all. But it was thrilling. So I was quite disappointed when I was taken off crime to then go on to medical reporting. I thought that was a bit of a demotion. That was seen as a softer subject.
What was that transition like?
Well, I was immediately fascinated, really, because medicine is such an enormous subject, not just medicine, but healthcare, you know, organisation of hospitals, management of healthcare, such a broad subject. And I was really absorbed. I was very lucky then to meet some very good managers and doctors who took me under their wing and explained a lot. So I learned quite quickly and just found there were so many questions, so many issues, so much to really get my teeth into. So I haven't stopped. I've always carried on writing about those issues ever since.
You know, you telling us your story, kind of your background, explains so much about even your style of writing, about the kind of the two worlds of the lover of reading, the lover of the kind of the more fantastical world, the better, and then your journalistic integrity, because your book really is a hybrid of that meticulously researched while remaining very artistic in its prose. Your writing is just beautiful. Reminds me very much of the works of Eric Larson, who has written a lot of the same type of historic nonfiction, but with a sense of storytelling that is so impactful. So it's always interesting to meet a writer like yourself because that's a real right brain, left brain combination, the creative and the analytical all at once. How do you juggle those two dynamics when you write? Does it come naturally to you to write both analytically and creatively simultaneously, Or do you do a passive detail or an outline of detail before the creative process? What does that look like for you?
Well, that's very kind of you to say that. Yeah, I suppose I aim to do those two things. Those are my key things. I want to tell the facts as clearly as I can, but I want to make it readable so the readers want to turn the page. So there are a lot of things happening at the same time. I always say I think writing is as much about thinking as it's about writing. So I spend quite a lot of time. I do a lot of research, a lot of reading around the subject.
Yes.
But I also do quite a bit of daydreaming, if you like, on trains or in bed at night sometimes. I'm thinking through how to tell this story. And I'm always looking for those little details, those little bits of colour that will bring the story to life and make it authentic. So, you know, you can say somebody, you know, walked to the hospital, but if they walked to the hospital and they saw, they were crunching on the gravel as they went and they saw the sky was blue, you know, immediately you're building up a picture. So I'm constantly looking for those little nuggets of detail that will bring the story more to life. So I'm actually sort of working on a new book at the moment. So I'm gathering all the facts, but I'm also writing a notebook to sort of work out how to unravel this story, really, how to tell it best so that the reader wants to keep reading it.
Yes, fantastic.
Wendy, when we first met, it was at the London's famous Wellcome Trust and Archives. And at that time, I was working on my first book. And we had a great conversation about John Hunter and about London and early parts of your career. You were so charitable to actually meet with me at the time, just complete unknown. And you looked at me, and you probably the one thing I took away the most from that, you looked at me and you said, detail. Add more detail, keep detail. And that has just rung with me. And I've gotten to meet lots of authors since then and people in the entertainment industry as well. But you add the detail, you put the reader in that spot. And when you're covering such glorious people, it's great. Where did you come about? Was that your life as a journalist that you picked that up, or just stuff you love to read?
I suppose, it's partly journalism, because as a journalist, you're told find the colour. So you tell a news story, but you want to tell the story. It's like that famous photograph from Vietnam of a battleground, but there's a teddy bear at the front. So it's that detail that makes it human. So it's the human connection. So that's partly from the journalism, but it is also from fiction too, I think, because I did also study creative writing. I went to lots of creative writing courses. And one of the things I picked up from there was the importance of that really specific detail, often unique detail, and the use of the five senses.
Yes.
So that really brings a story to life much more.
Along those lines, even though you're writing about history and about people who really lived, do you, and maybe this is intentional or unintentional, do you see yourself in the shoes of your protagonist, of one single specific character that you kind of come at from their point of view above all others and see yourself in a little bit? It feels that way. Is that the way you come about it?
Yeah, I try to put myself in the shoes of the main character and, you know, put myself in their head. So if I'm writing a scene, I'll try to unfold it as if I'm there. That's often that can be difficult when the character's not very likable, or like,
yes.
You know, I wrote one book about a very unlikable man. And in the case of John Hunter, where my quest all the time was trying to decide whether or not he really was villain or hero.
Right.
So I was constantly trying to see through his eyes and understand his world, I suppose that's it. And not necessarily apologize or, you know, justify what he did, but to understand what he did in his world. So I think that's probably my aim.
Well, you have to make it compelling. You've got to see things from their perspective. Doesn't mean that you agree with them, but everyone thinks they're right, correct?
Yes, absolutely. You know? Yes.
Wendy, let's pivot now to No Man's Land, your incredible work. You've written about this little-known moment in medical history. Tell us about the moment of inspiration. Where were you and what did you see that really triggered your interest in this Endell Street Hospital?
Well, I was at the Wellcome Library where we met originally. I've been looking for a new story for a book in medical history. Mm-hmm. And I saw a painting on the wall, and it was a painting of an operating theatre. And all the people were women, So the patient was male, all the doctors, all the nurses were female. And that would be strange enough today, quite unusual today.
Right.
But then I realised that the painting was of a hospital in the First World War.
Wow.
So I was intrigued to find out about this hospital where the operating theatre was staffed by women and found out that very little had been written about it previously. So I just wanted to tell that story.
It's an incredible story, and I love your book so much. You know, it starts in September of 1914. The American view of World War I is likely different than it is for you and your fellow Brits. You know, the war was very present on the home front there in Great Britain, but not so much for Americans. Kind of paint the picture for us. What was happening in the 19-teens there in London? What would have been like for people living in London itself?
Well, you're right. For us, the war began in August 1914, and it came as quite a surprise to British people at the time. They knew Germany was mobilising. Even when Germany invaded Belgium and then France, well, Belgium initially, people in Britain didn't expect that they would be involved in the war. But in order to safeguard Belgian neutrality, Britain declared war on Germany. So on the 5th of August, people woke up and found themselves at war. So there was no preparation, no expectation of that. It came as a big surprise, really. But immediately, men started volunteering to go to the front. Women started volunteering to provide service on the home front, and things moved very quickly.
So, you know, as Americans, we know about the Blitzkrieg of World War II and just these armadas of the German bombers coming and bombing the dickens out of London. But it was a surprise for me in your book to be reminded that these Zeppelins, these plodding air balloons, were coming and they were dropping bombs, sometimes by hand, out of these Zeppelins over London. That was, I'm ashamed to admit, I didn't really realize that. What would that have been like for Londoners in that era, summer after summer?
It's hard to imagine, isn't it? I think a lot of British people didn't really know about that very much as well. We know about the Battle of Britain over London, but right, not so much about the Zeppelins and the other planes that dropped bombs on London in the First World War. And when you think that it's not that long, it hadn't been that long since there were planes in the sky at all. So when people saw these Zeppelins coming over, they came out to watch them. They were just fascinated to see these things, and they watched them dropping bombs. There's quite a lot of descriptions of people standing in the streets, looking out of their windows, watching these Zeppelins raining down bombs on London. So it was devastating, really. London was very unprotected. There were very, very few defences. And so people were really at the mercy of these bombs. Mm.
Thinking about how unexpected and devastating that really would be, just absolutely life-shattering for so many of these people in that dangerous time. But you present in your book something that we really don't think about that often, which was this war was also, as well as a dangerous time, for women specifically, it was a moment of tremendous opportunity. And that is the hope-centric story that you tell in the book. Tell us a little bit about how the war was a moment for women to seize.
It was very much that. The two women I'm writing about in the book were suffragettes. So they had been campaigning for the vote. Women in Britain had been campaigning for the vote for decades, and that had become a very sort of militant campaign in the few years leading up to the war. That, you know, there were arson attacks on places, there were bomb attacks, so it had become, you know, really very violent. But when the war happened, most of those women then put their energies into supporting the war effort. And that was partly driven by patriotism. They wanted to serve their country. But it was also driven by this aim to show that women were equal to men,
yes,
that they could do everything that men could. So women ended up driving buses, working in factories, digging graves, working in hospitals. And that was partly because of their campaign for the vote. They felt they deserved the vote. But they were also trying to show that they were equal to any man.
Yes. And here we come to the magic of the story, in particular your two heroines, the Louisa Garrett Anderson and Flora Murray. Who were these two women, and why were they really so iconoclastic?
Louisa Garrett Anderson, she was the daughter of Elizabeth Garrett Anderson, who had been the first woman to train in Britain to become a doctor in 1865. So Louisa had followed her mother into medicine. Flora Murray was a doctor as well. So they were both doctors. They'd trained in a women's school of medicine because there were very few other opportunities.
The London School of Medicine for Women.
Exactly. But their qualifications were exactly identical to any doctor's qualification, any male doctor's qualifications. Mm-hmm. But as women doctors, they'd been confined to treating only women and children. Women doctors were barred basically from working in mainstream hospitals. They weren't allowed to work in surgery. They weren't allowed to treat men. It was taboo for women doctors to treat men. Even though women nurses treated men all the time, women doctors did not treat men. So they, as you might imagine, were pretty angry at this situation.
Yep.
And that's partly why they'd both enrolled as suffragettes and campaigned avidly for the vote. So Louisa had actually been to prison for 4 weeks for smashing a window as part of the campaign. And Flora, in a way,
she was not well behaved.
No, you could say
I
that.
I love that.
No, indeed. Well, she was risking her reputation quite seriously as a doctor by going to prison, by becoming a public figure, enemy, really. And Flora Murray, who was 4 years older than her, was even more involved. She was actually Mrs. Pankhurst, the suffragette leader's doctor. So she treated many of the suffragettes who were sent to prison and were force-fed there. And she even helped some of them to escape. So she was definitely risking her professional qualifications for that. And they were also partners. So Flora and Louisa lived together as a married couple, essentially.
So I want to backtrack a little bit to the mom, because Elizabeth Garrett Anderson, herself such a pioneer, she had to use, of course, a backdoor route to try and become a doctor. She was trained as this apothecary, a pharmacist, in the 1860s, medical school in Paris, where women were allowed to go to medical school. So she did this workaround to be able to come back to England and be part of the founding of that London School of Medicine for Women, thus paving the route for her own daughter and kind of financially supporting her as well. But those early women, I just can't imagine. You finally go to the medical school, this London School of Medicine for Women, and as you say, you're a doctor, but there's no job for you. So then they end up forming, they function basically oftentimes as primary care docs, OBGYN, and that's, of course, then Louisa Garrett Anderson's training as a surgeon was her work as a gynecologist and obstetrician, right?
Yes, indeed. I mean, most women doctors ended up either working in private practice, although that was still very difficult, or they set up small hospitals themselves for women and children. And in fact, Louisa and Flora ran a hospital themselves for children. Right. It was a tiny hospital, only had 7 beds, but they were treating very poor people in a poor part of London.
That new hospital for women is where they work. So, you know, yeah, you get to become a doctor, but you not only have to work in your own little hospital, but it's likely just going to be for indigent care and for people with no money. So we're going to let you be a doctor, but we're not going to let you earn a good living.
Yeah, I think the first generation of women doctors, the pioneer women doctors like Elizabeth Garrett Anderson, were really, they were just keen to break through and qualify in medicine.
Yes.
But it was the second generation, like Louisa, her daughter, and other women, who were not satisfied with that.
Yes.
They knew their qualifications were just as good as male doctors. And so they were angry at not being allowed to do everything that the male doctors could, you know, working in mainstream hospitals, getting the experience. They wanted to climb the ladder, becoming surgeons. So Louisa, in particular, was a surgeon and she wanted to do every aspect of surgery. She was known as a dexterous surgeon. So she had done operations on women, but before the war had never operated on a man.
Well, and I love that Louisa and Flora took that dissatisfaction and instead of only standing up and protesting, they also said, we are going to create our own opportunities. We are going to force people to see that we can not only do everything a man can do, we can surpass what men can do. We're going to create the opportunities for ourselves, such pioneers for women's rights by capability. And that is, it's very moving and it's very profound. Unpack for us some of what they accomplished, and really, what are some of today's realities that would never have been possible without the path that these two women forged?
Well, you're right. I mean, they were absolutely determined and they were very well connected because of their suffragette network. So as soon as the war started, they decided immediately they were going to go to war, that they would take a unit of women to France. They knew that the British government wouldn't accept them because the British Army had already rejected other women doctors who'd gone to them. So they raised the money themselves, £2,000, a lot of money in those days, yes, to buy supplies. They recruited three other women doctors and nurses and orderlies, and they took their team of 18 people to Paris in September. So they were actually the first women-only unit to go abroad in the war. And they went to Paris to set up a hospital there at the behest of the French Red Cross. So the French Red Cross were happy to accept them. And they ran a hospital in Claridge's Hotel in Paris. So that was a luxury hotel which had opened. It is still there, and I've stayed there since, actually, yeah, which is quite a treat. But it had not actually opened at that point. And so the hospital was given over to them the hotel was given over to them to run as a hospital. And they turned it round in 2 days. They turned it from this empty hotel into a functioning hospital within 2 days,
incredible,
which is staggering, I think.
We're speaking with Wendy Moore, author of No Man's Land. You are listening to Your Life Depends on It. We'll be right back.
The most astounding aspect of what Murray and Anderson accomplished is that they did not wait for a seat at the table. They built their own table. In a world where the major hospitals would not grant them access, they transformed a facility from the ground up, a hub of healing that literally saved the lives of hundreds of British soldiers. We here at Media Fabrica see this strategy as an inspiration to all of us. History has always favored those who expend their energies creating new doors for themselves, those who take the fire of their rage and injustice and funnel it into action and invention. And in fact, most breakthroughs in human equality came because someone provided solutions that no one had considered before. Arguments are necessary, but they rarely change the mind of the dissenting opinion. What upends ideologies is ingenuity. Coming at problems and setbacks and prejudices from unexpected and creative angles. Unique angles that require unique points of view to see them. Oppression and inequality are harsh and cruel and deserve no place in our modern world. But it is not legislation that changes the hearts and minds of the population. It is the unique voice, the unparalleled ideas of specific individuals from each and every group speaking up, taking action, and building their own table.
So tell me a little bit about the uniforms themselves. I love that part where they form their own corps and they realize, well, we're not an official army branch here. So what did they do, Wendy?
Well, they designed their own uniforms too, and they did see to every detail. So Flora and Louisa decided that they would wear smart military style uniforms in a kind of khaki sort of color so that they would look, you know, military, but they would be functional as well. So they kitted themselves out in these uniforms. They went off to Paris and started treating soldiers who were injured in the war.
I laughed out loud when I was reading that part because you said that they decided to make their dress, you know, the dresses went all the way to the ankle, but showed just the tiniest bit of ankle,
scandalous,
like ankle bone, which was rather daring and scandalous.
Yeah, so they were daringly short for the time, that's right.
And so they show up in Paris, they set this up, and I'm going to read a couple of your sentences to you. I love how you describe as quickly apprising their surroundings. Anderson and Murray decided that the four large salons on the ground floor would best serve as wards. They were situated surroundings as open courtyard, the lady's cloakroom with its tiled walls and floor, plentiful wash basins, and light reflecting mirrors could be converted into an operating theater, and the adjoining rooms on either side would become a dispensary and a sterilizing room with fish kettles pressed into use as sterilizing units. So this brand new hotel, they just take over the rooms and start sprucing it up. And this is one of the elegant touches, is that they actually make it a homey place as opposed to the grungy hospitals where guys would otherwise have been treated.
Well, that was really important to them, actually, because they were twin aims. They were determined to run a hospital that was every bit as good as an army hospital. So yep. Just as efficient and, you know, well organized as an army hospital. But they wanted it both ways. They wanted to be like men, but they also wanted to add this woman's yes. touch too. So they wanted their hospital to be a homely, colourful, cheerful place. And there was a lot of logic to that. Louisa herself said she believed that the men were as wounded in their minds as in their bodies, which we know now was true. A lot of the men did suffer from a dreadful shell shock or were traumatised by the war. And so they did set out to comfort the men as much as to nurse them and treat them.
Hmm. Well, and obviously that was very wise on their part to be feminine and then to have the similarity to the men, because they were the transition in the thinking, correct? And they knew this. They knew that, that what they were building was going to be what opened the gateway for women to do what had been happening in a man's world. Researching these two women must have been so inspiring to you personally. Obviously, you're telling a greater story, but you can't help but also be kind of learning about your own story in the process of researching theirs, right? What was probably the most personal revelation for you of inspiration, the way these women inspired you in your life, your living, and the way that you, maybe you decided you were going to change your thinking moving forward?
Yes, that's interesting. I suppose I didn't really know that much about the suffragettes before I'd started researching the book. I mean, I knew they had fought for the vote and that some of them had gone to prison and they'd been force-fed. But I was, you know, really impressed by the number of women that were involved and the lengths to which they went to campaign for the vote. So it made me really think quite hard about the fact that I obviously take the vote for granted, like most women do today. But would I have gone to those lengths? Would I have smashed windows and gone to prison? It really made me think quite hard about commitment and campaigning and what we're prepared to do for yes. our beliefs. So, yeah, I stand in awe of those women completely. And then during the war, they went through the most incredible privations. You know, they were working incredibly hard. A lot of the time they didn't have adequate food. They had bombs coming down. It was exhausting work. And again, it really made me appreciate the lengths to which they'd gone to do what they thought was right.
To do this yes. work, of course.
Yes, yes, absolutely. Yeah, and I think we do take for granted a lot of what those women did. I suppose the most shocking thing was that after the war, they were then told to just go back to doing what they'd done before. And that was probably the most shocking and devastating part of the story for me. I think that's probably what made me saddest of all, really.
Right. Louisa and Flora bravely established their hospital first in Paris, and then, of course, they advanced and got even closer to the war front. But then it dawns on them, what we actually can do is go back to London. Now that we're gaining approval and everyone can see that our methodology is working very well, we'll build our own hospital. How did that come about, and where did they decide to plant their flag in London?
Well, originally they'd run a hospital in Paris. That hospital had been inspected by army chiefs who'd come out quite hostile. Right. And then realised, actually, this is really working well. So on the basis of that, the army had asked them then to run a hospital near Boulogne in France. But the women, they had pretty much decided to, they'd done their bit by that point. But in early 1915, when the army realised that they needed thousands more beds in London on the home front, they then asked Flora and Louisa if they would run a hospital in London. And they didn't hesitate. They immediately said yes. So this was quite a big gamble. It was a unique opportunity. The army chief himself had been told that not to do this, that it was too big a gamble to ask women to run a hospital and women doctors to treat men, that the men wouldn't accept it. But he had gone ahead, so it was a big gamble. Other people said that it wouldn't last 6 months, but they went ahead and they opened Endell Street Military Hospital in London in May 1915.
Right. And it was in an old workhouse. And for people who have visited London, this is in the heart of London. It's not in the city itself, the city of London, that small circumscribed area, but it's right by Covent Garden, right by that Apple store now.
Which was not there in 1915. Just so
the Apple store was not there.
Yeah. Yeah, it was right in the heart of London, Covent Garden, theatre land. It was the centre of the theatre world, close to the West End where the shops were. So it was actually one of 300 military hospitals in London. But Endell Street was one of the biggest 20 in London.
Yeah.
And within central London, it was one of the 10 largest hospitals. And because it was very close to a railway station, to Charing Cross railway station, it received some of the, most of the most seriously wounded soldiers.
So all these injuries were coming in by train. They were crossing the channel because, of course, the channel did not exist yet either. Then they would come by train up to Charing Cross or Victoria Station and be ferried just by transport to Endell Street, that short distance. Tell me about deeds and not words. That phrase, what does it mean for the hospital? What does it mean for you?
Well, deeds, not words, was the suffragettes' motto. That was Mrs. Pankhurst had decided on that motto because they had enough of government words.
Right.
They wanted to see deeds. So they then took that into their own hands and they decided to perform deeds, to take action themselves in order to get the vote. And Flora and Louisa adopted that motto as their motto. So that was the motto that was written inside Endell Street over the little theatre that they had there. And that's what they did. That's what the women were doing. They were showing through deeds and not through words that they could do exactly what they wanted to do, that they could do everything that male doctors could do.
How beautiful that now, this many years later, by telling their story, you have done deeds through words.
You could say that indeed, yes. I hope I've done them justice, yeah.
And I like how you say later in the book that really a new woman was born in the war. You had this glass ceiling where women absolutely couldn't go to the same medical school. They certainly couldn't practice in the same hospital. And all they did is paying their own way, buying their own uniforms, paying for their own medicine and equipment and sterilizers, and showing that they could do it. As a surgeon myself, one of the things that blows me away is that Louisa Garrett Anderson was able to take the skills she had, essentially as a gynecological surgeon, and to be able to treat war wounds. Mm-hmm. And just like everyone else in that era, trying to figure out what war surgery was like, mm-hmm. I have such crazy respect for her ability to adapt and make herself into a war surgeon.
Well, absolutely. I mean, she had no experience in military surgery. She had no experience of operating on men. Flora, who was the anaesthetist, had no experience of anaesthetising men. So they learned very quickly. But the thing to remember is that the injuries that doctors saw in the war were unprecedented.
Yes.
So they were seeing horrific injuries, awful head injuries, gaping wounds. Vast majority of those wounds were infected with gangrene. So these wounds were unprecedented for all doctors. So male doctors were inexperienced too. So they became experts in treating those war wounds very quickly.
I'll remind listeners that still no antibiotics. Antibiotics were not clinically given until 1941. So the entirety of World War I was fought with zero antibiotics. And it was the advent of chemical warfare. And it was the time when munitions were becoming much, much more dangerous. So you just had, for people who have seen the film 1917, you had this no man's land and people just shelling each other all day long, and they'd be injured, ferried all the way back to London, and wave by wave at this new Endell Street Hospital, along would come these makeshift ambulances bringing all these men with injuries that were not an hour old, which is the golden hour in trauma surgery, but hours and or days old.
That's right.
What was that like for these women receiving these injured men?
Well, that's right. I mean, some of the men would have had some very basic emergency surgery in France before they were moved on. But in, at times of very big advances where there were lots of casualties, the men would be brought straight to Endell Street. Sometimes they were actually there within 8 hours, so that was very quick, but still, as you say, not really fast enough. So they were treating all sorts of injuries. They were having to deal with head injuries, eye injuries, lots of orthopaedic injuries, so broken bones, very badly broken bones with compound wounds. So it was a massive variety of injuries. So Louisa had, she was the main surgeon. She had 8 assistant surgeons who worked on a rota. So doctors, women doctors came to work at Endell Street from not only all over Britain, but all over the world. So
yes.
She had surgeons coming from Australia. There were 4 Australian women surgeons, 1 from Canada, all came to help her. And they worked very long hours. What would happen would be that a convoy would arrive, usually in the middle of the night, and then a bell would be rung in the courtyard and the ambulance would pull into the courtyard and then the men would be unloaded. So they'd be assessed by the doctors and then taken up to the wards and either prepared for surgery for the next, usually for the next day, or nursed until they were recovered. So it was incredibly hard work, grueling work.
And it just went on day after day and then year after year. And this is in a time when, you know, wars were still mostly, there was a season of war. So things would maybe calm down a little bit over the winter. But here in their own hospital, thinking that they're well away from the front, as we briefly alluded to before, come the Zeppelins. And tell the story about when the Zeppelin bombing came close to Endell Street.
But there were several occasions when bombs dropped nearby to Endell Street. But on one occasion, there was somewhere, it was actually a Gotha plane. So it was this huge German plane that dropped a bomb at the very bottom corner of Endell Street. So just about 100 yards from the hospital.
Right.
And this is one of the most serious bombs of the war in London, when hundreds of people died in this. It was a printing factory that had been used as an air raid shelter. So people were sheltering in the basement. Many died from the bomb blast. And then because water tanks then leaked and lots of people then drowned in there too. So some of those casualties were taken to the gates of Endell Street.
It was pretty touching when I realized that Elizabeth Garrett Anderson, the mother, actually was still alive during this time. She got to live to see, got into her 80s, to see what her daughter had actually pulled off. Now, she died in 1917 in the middle of the war. We talked briefly about what it was like for, you know, your own parents to see your book, or what it's like to dedicate one of your books to one of your kids. What do you think it was like for Elizabeth Garrett Anderson to see her daughter functioning as a surgeon, taking care of these soldiers?
Well, she was becoming quite forgetful by that point. She had become what they call wandery. She went to see Louisa and Flora off when they left to go to France. And she's supposed to have said if she'd been younger, she would have gone with them too. Mm. That might be apocryphal. It sounds a little bit too neat almost, but that's the story. But I think for Louisa, she really wanted to tell her mother what she was doing. So she writes back from France to her mother to tell her how the hospital's running and to talk about the operations that she's doing. Because I think she knows that her mother is the person who will most understand what this is, you know, that this pioneering work that she's doing, that her mother would never have been allowed to have treated a man. So it is, yeah, a very touching story.
We are speaking with Wendy Moore, author of No Man's Land. You are listening to Your Life Depends on It. We'll be right back.
Let's take a minute to chew on what Wendy Moore stated was a suffragette motto: deeds, not words. This is a statement of proactivity, of being intentional about the good you do. Our modern world is in dire need of this approach to problem solving. A century ago, the British suffragettes were growing tired of talking much and achieving little. In modern parlance, deeds not words might be rephrased, talk is cheap. The modern megaphone of conflict dialogue is social media, but the bite-sized social media exchanges rarely win the day. Instead of merely arguing,
What if we invested our resources and our energies in building concrete change, no matter how small at first, but drive toward actually making a difference? Might not be as revolutionary as the woman's right to vote, but there may come to mind an issue you care about deeply, but have found little success. Put into action an ideal you hold dear, instead of just being a social media sleigh master. Deeds, not words. Show the world the productive good of your ideology. Then, your argument is far more likely to actually change someone's mind.
Well, so, you know, here we are. A full century has passed since what happened to Louisa Garrett Anderson and Flora Murray and their efforts, and when they were relegated to go back to what they had been doing before the war. You know, there was a great cost to that decision, putting them back in the wrongful place. And yet here 100 years later, you know, in some ways we've grown and learned a lot, and in some ways we haven't. We are still relegating people groups, and we are still denying people opportunities. You know, what should we learn from what it cost these women to be removed from the positions that they had held in the world? What can we learn and hopefully do differently now?
Well, I suppose that's what drove me to write the book partly, is that it's a story that wasn't well known, but it's a story that still is relevant to us today, because it's about women, people, fighting for their rights, fighting for their opportunities, fighting for equality. Women doctors still, women in general, are still in many ways fighting for equality. In this country, for example, women now make up 48% of the medical workforce. So women doctors nearly in medicine in equal numbers, but they are still not at equal levels. So they're in jobs that are lower paid, lower status. Yes. So there's still a long way to go. You know, we haven't got there yet. A lot of women doctors, you know, text me and get in touch with me and say that they're still experiencing a lot of those same things. So I think it tells us to keep fighting for equality, to, you know, remember that it's a long battle, that we have to persevere, that we have to, you know, to just, it's going back to that kind of social justice issue that we talked about at the beginning. You know, I think we need to fight for equal opportunity for everybody. It's as really simple as that, I think.
And if we have more opportunity, I'm sure to fight for the opportunities of those alongside us who don't, to not merely relegate them to fight alone for themselves, but to champion those.
Mm-hmm. I mean, yes. I mean, I think I was kind of most intrigued in particular by a lot of the men who were fighting alongside the suffragettes during that battle. There were many men who were supporting them at the same time, and some of them went to prison as well and took action too. So that, yeah, that's something that we forget as well, I think.
Including the original grouchy officer, British officer who came to Paris to do the inspection. Huh. He ended up turning and becoming one of the people that supported the effort.
Yeah, I suppose that's another lesson, isn't it? To be open-minded, because some of those male army officers who came out quite prejudiced, expecting to see the worst, they then had their minds changed, and they were willing to change and then to fight and became allies of these women and, you know, fought for their rights as well. So I think, yeah, we should all remember that, you know, be open-minded, be willing to learn and to change.
One of the things I found really inspiring about it was the mindset, both among particularly our two protagonists. In one of the letters back, she said, despite the long hours, it felt like a sort of holiday. And I think that was written from Boulogne, that, you know, you're in the midst of this shattering war experience, but you have adopted this mindset that you're on an adventure and you're accomplishing something that you otherwise could not be pulling off. And without blowing too much of the end, because everyone listening to this should get the book or the audiobook, you know, on the tombstone, buried together, it said, "We have been gloriously happy."
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wow.
I think it was partly a mindset. They came from quite privileged backgrounds. They've been quite well educated. They've been taught to be positive, to believe they could do things. And they put that into their work. But I think the other thing that perhaps came across to me most strongly writing the book was that although these women were working incredibly hard, giving up long hours, sacrificing their lives, they actually were having a time of their lives at the same time.
Beautiful.
They were enjoying this opportunity to prove that they were as good as anybody else. They were working together. There was this huge camaraderie. So they were determined to be optimistic, to keep cheerful, to keep their spirits high. And it was exhilarating. That's the kind of overall feeling that I came away with.
You know, the research from my book, The Invention of Surgery, you know, across the board, you see a lot of these pioneering surgeons like your own John Hunter as well. More often than not, they end up being a little bit crazy. They're nut jobs who often, you know, the Isaac Newtons and these other people who end up living these solitary as an oyster, as Dickens would say.
Yeah.
Terribly unhealthy, who didn't have very deep relationships, but yet with our two protagonists here, just an amazing relationship, obviously, with each other, despite going through all this stress, and with their own families and the people around them. What do you think? What's the difference? Why do so many women do better at relationships than men? It's dangerous to generalize.
What's
the knack?
That's a whole other podcast right there.
That's very interesting. And I think you're right that Flora and Louisa, they were absolutely devoted to each other throughout their lives. They were totally, you know, dedicated. So, and running Angel Street was part of their commitment to each other, really. It was proving their love to each other. But at the same time, they were seen as being very difficult people too. Almost they were being male in that way too. They were very strict disciplinarians. They were very austere. So they did have to be like men in lots of ways in order to run this hospital, to make sure it ran smoothly, to make sure everybody did what they were told. So yeah, they kind of probably fit into that stereotype of the difficult medical pioneer as well, I would say.
I do wonder if one of the factors that maybe made all the difference is the partnership, you know, that lends itself in many ways to, you know, you can't be an iconoclast, you can't have it all be your way or the highway. Many of these other geniuses that David mentions in the history of medicine and the history of surgery, they were islands unto themselves. And here you have two women who had a whole different perspective of lifting all boats and doing it together. Mm. And just mm-hmm. that aspect of not only camaraderie, but community mm-hmm. changed something in the, maybe it's a distance and selfishness, whatever it is, but changed something in the dynamic that allowed them to live healthier, more productive lives.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And they learned that in the suffragettes. They learned that by women working together, by networking, by organizing together, they could achieve things better. So that experience is what they put into running their hospital. So they learned that first of all, women could do anything if they had the proper training and the opportunities, and they applied that to the hospital.
Yep.
But they also they believed in women being achieving things. But they also used those connections, that networking experience, to work together as a unified organization.
The suffragette aspect is so interesting to me because a similar kind of mathematics happened in America. Most people would miss this trivia question for American listeners. Where did women first have the right to vote? Was it New York? Was it Connecticut? Was it New Jersey? Maybe somewhere around D.C.? No, it was the state of Wyoming, which is insane. But in a similar fashion, part of the thing that I think drove the suffragettes crazy in London was the fact that in Australia and New Zealand, women already could vote. Why is it that out in the boonies, women were more readily accepted as having a vote than in the central area of power? Do you have an explanation for that?
I don't know. I don't actually know that. I know that women surgeons came from Australia to work at Angel Street, and they thought, you know, why are they banging on about the vote all the time? You know, we've got the vote already.
Right.
But at the same time, the women surgeons in Australia had exactly the same issues of not being able to work in mainstream hospitals.
Right.
So they had the vote. I think that was probably some sort of quirk, really, if it hadn't brought equality. And the thing about the vote was that the women fighting for the vote that wasn't a be-all and end-all. That was a symbol of equality. Yeah. So that was just a beginning, exactly. Really. Yeah.
I have a theory, and we could just bounce it off of you guys, that, you know, those Midwestern areas that were farmland, you know, and the farming was more of an equalizer because everyone had to do backbreaking work. Male, female, old, young, it didn't matter. Everyone had to chip in or else they wouldn't survive. The more elite the work was, the more men attempted to exclude women out of it. And that may be a substantial reason why you found those rural areas giving women the right to vote, because they already saw them on a day-to-day basis as pulling equal weight.
You may be right there. I think there's also a kind of ownership issue, because often the vote was tied to ownership of a house or property. Certainly in Britain, that was the case. Even after women got the vote in 1918, that only went to women over 30 who had some property. So, it may be that that's another issue as well.
Yeah. I know my great-grandmother was, you know, she was a pioneering scout in Wyoming and led hunting camps, and everyone knew she was the best rifle person around, and ran the chuck wagon. So I think there is something to that mark, and of just, you know, this leveling of no, you know, I just knew these apocryphal stories. No one wanted to mess with my great grandmother.
She sounds like she's worthy of a book there, I think.
I think so. I've thought about it. So, you know, tell us about your experiences now with the script and options and the Hollywood thing. Because as I read this, all I kept thinking is, I don't know if this is a feature film or I don't know if this is a series. I hope it's more than just 2 hours, because the story is just so rich. Are you still interested? What's the update, Wendy?
Oh, well.
Or can you talk about it? Or
I can say a little bit. I mean, we have agreed an option with a film company, so we're hoping there'll be a TV series.
Amen to that.
But I don't know. I don't know more. I can't say more. I don't really know more about that at the moment.
Well, let me ask a philosophical question then, that you wouldn't be giving anything away. How is it for you as the historian who chronicled those stories? What does it feel like, you know, passing that baton to Hollywood or networks? And I'm not talking about a specific network, but do you, in the back of your mind before those deals come through, do you have concerns with how these true people will be represented, how much they'll get right?
Yes, completely. Because I do feel that I owe a debt to the people I've been writing about. A lot of the information I've used has come from families of descendants of women who worked at the hospital or patients who were treated there. So I really feel I do owe them, you know, have a responsibility to them to make sure it's right. So I would do everything I can that's in my power to make sure that does happen. But, you know, I think it's important to bring stories like this to a wider audience, and so that everyone knows about it, so that children grow up knowing that this happened, you know, not we don't have to wait till we're, you know, middle-aged or whatever to find these stories out. We should know that these things happened in schools. It should be taught, yeah.
Where do you feel their presence the most? Is it when you walk down Endell Street itself today? Is it when you go to that Claridge's Hotel in Paris or Boulogne? Where do you feel it?
Well, I go to those places because I want to walk in their footsteps. And I always try to put myself in the position of the people I'm writing about. But it's always very hard to do that. You know, everything's different. So the place where it becomes most real is always in a library or an archive. Come back to libraries, really, because it's reading letters, usually letters or diaries from the people I'm writing about, that really brings it home to me. It's touching the paper that they've written on or opened, and reading their words. And especially with this story, because there's a marvellous archive of letters and material, but also this wonderful scrapbook which Flora Murray herself collected. So she collected news cuttings and photographs of Endell Street because she wanted it to be remembered. She wanted it to be, you know, she knew the hospital probably wouldn't last forever. It closed at the end of the war.
Right.
And she wanted the story to last and to be told. And that's really where it comes home to me most often. Yeah.
Well, that couldn't be more touching. And as Mark alluded to earlier, you have pulled it off,
yes.
Deeds and words. And it's a great homage to those two. And I myself can't wait to see the television series. I think it'll be spectacular. Wendy Moore, thank you so much for sharing your creativity, your insight. And thank you for sharing this book with us. Really, really appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much to both of you too. It's been such a pleasure to talk to you.
Where can readers find your work and where can they find you online?
Well, I have a website, so it's www.wendymoore.org. So details of my books are there, and the books are in bookshops too, so I hope people will enjoy them.
Perfect. Thank you so much again for joining us.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much.
You are listening to Your Life Depends on It. We'll be right back. Fantastic interview today with author Wendy Moore. You know, David, I like to consider you and I the Louisa Garrett Anderson and Flora Murray of the podcast world. I like to think of us that way. I'm wrong, but I'd like to.
Just feels like so much pioneering going on.
So much pioneering. We are carving the new trench of podcast. Well, David Schneider is known for knowing three interesting things about everything. And of course, in a fascinating interview like the one we just had, I'm sure the window of insight has been opened for all new categories. So David, let's talk about the three things that you are going to take away with you from our conversation today with author Wendy Moore. What's number one?
I think one of the most important things is how much education has changed for women in just the last 100 years. You know, it wasn't really until the 1870s that women across Great Britain could even start going to classes and attending classes, but they were not allowed to get a degree.
It's insane.
That didn't happen until 100 years ago at Oxford and Cambridge. So it wasn't until 1920 that you could be a woman, go to one of those schools, and then actually get a degree. You know, you've earned it, but you were finally allowed to get a degree. And just when that seems odd to our ears, then you have to contemplate that all the way until the 1960s, there were no women getting degrees in any of the American Ivy League schools. My father-in-law graduated from Yale in 1960, and Yale was, in 1960, was still only a men's college. That boggles the mind.
And didn't all of that kind of stem from the mindset of the church? Correct me if I'm wrong, because there was such a stigma that women weren't allowed to be a part of that. And, you know, so much of education, of Ivy League education, stemmed out of the church, did it not? Is that where that came from originally?
Well, it did. That's a major part of it. But the other part of it, their kind of cop-out, which was different than Oxford and Cambridge, was that there were these seven sisters. You had these Ivy League schools that all had their associated women's colleges, Vassar, et cetera. And so they would say, well, if you want to go to this really prestigious school, and oftentimes they were physically next to each other. Just like, go over there. You're That's welcome right. over there. Just leave us alone here at Harvard, Yale, Princeton, whatever. And so it's in our lifetime, Mark, that these schools started allowing women to go to Harvard and Yale and get a degree. So it's not insane. That long ago.
Yeah. And even after all those years, there's still absolutely no women in One Direction or Menudo or these boy bands. We have a long way to go. And, you know, some areas we're seeing growth, and in other areas, just nothing.
And this is the only reason that I won't listen to Menudo.
Absolutely. When are they going to make a Womenudo? That's what I want to know. When are they going to be fair about it? All right. What is the second takeaway that you have from this conversation?
That once again, crisis means opportunity.
Yes.
And, you know, that Flora Murray and Elizabeth Garrett Anderson, I'm sorry, Louisa Garrett Anderson,
yes,
because the mother was Elizabeth Garrett Anderson, that Louisa and Flora themselves use this crisis to really create this opportunity. And, of course, it begs us to believe and to trust and to see that right now, in the midst of this obvious crisis that we're all in America, that there is opportunity. And it's going to be not just this opportunity to crush the coronavirus. There's going to be all these tangential discoveries that's going to happen, that are going to happen. And we should be receptive to that and really take advantage of crisis.
You know, their mindset is so inspiring and even convicting at the same time, because they were set in a time and an era where all signs pointed to
them not having the opportunities, not having the freedoms. And I just love to see the way they just seized every little chance, every little opportunity to push their way forward and to make a difference and to literally open doors of buildings for them. Create the building, build the door, push the door open.
Make your own uniforms.
Yes, make your own uniforms. You know, find a way to truck the patients in from the war field. And it's just, it's very inspiring. You know, it's a take on justice and fairness that I think everyone can see as something of immense value.
Yep. Which leads me to the third thing, Mark,
yeah,
which is, once again, you see that the people in the world that truly make a difference are the ones who are just going to crash through the barrier.
Yes.
In this case, break through the glass ceiling, whether it's William Wallace, whether it's these two incredible women, where you just finally say, you know, again, it's the deeds, not words, but just say, you know what? Thank you. You're at least pretending that you're listening to me, but now we're just going to take matters into our own hands. Yes. We're going to try and be civil, but it's the people and the Jackie Robinsons of the world who just say, we're going to go out there and we're not just going to show up. We're going to exceed expectations because we actually realize that we have to be better. Yes. We're going to have to be better than everyone around us because we don't want them to believe that they're just doing us a favor by letting us be around.
Right.
We're going to show up and we're going to actually do better. And that's how you break through the barriers.
That's
and it just becomes irrefutable that you belong at the table.
Well, there's always going to be a place for argument and debate and disagreements. Those things are important and those things are good. But history will mark and remember the accomplishers, right?
Yes.
The people who step up and say, I'm going to spend most of my energies assessing what makes me unique, gifted, able, and I'm going to give those gifts and those abilities to the world. I'm going to show them off. And that is my argument, right? Yep. That's the argument that shuts up the naysayers. Because what do you say to that? What do you say to the person who does it better? Keep doing it, please.
Right. And then there's nothing left to say. And next thing you know, it's like, and then something happened, and then they all lived happily ever after. Well, that's not, of course, the end of the story for these two incredible women, but they did pave the way, and they did it to excellence and drive and service.
They did, and that I think that's what's most important, that even though it is heartbreaking exactly how it ended for them, what came after them, the capabilities of women, the opportunities for women, those things would not have existed without the doors that they burst open.
That's right.
Dave, first of all, this was a great episode. This whole story of Louisa Garrett Anderson and Flora Murray, so inspirational, so timely for being a story that is so old, and yet so many of us did not know it. But for me, one of the most inspirational aspects was this suffragette motto, deeds, not words, how the two of them changed so many minds by taking such bold action and saving lives through that action, proving their perspective could be accomplished. So I just want to know, in your life of being inspired to drive you to your goals, has there ever been a moment in your life where your opinion on a matter was actually changed or shifted by seeing the deeds, the proactivity of someone else? Was there a moment when their deeds, not words, made you pivot in your thinking?
In my Denver practice, we're now, I think, 43 surgeon group.
Wow, that's incredible.
We partner together with this amazing local basketball coach and the NBA legend, Chauncey Bill. Lonnie Porter's the basketball coach. He's a legendary basketball coach. And Chauncey Billups, of course, he was the MVP of the NBA Finals and just the greatest basketball player and certainly in the Rocky Mountain history and really one of the better NBA plays ever.
I'm saying yes and right to all of your comments about these athletic facts to make it look like I'm in the know, but really I'm just trusting your wisdom.
So basketball fans will go, oh man, Chauncey Billups. So we have partnered with Coach Porter and Chauncey Billups, and they have this Porter Billups Leadership Academy.
Oh, wow.
And I think all of us it seems overwhelming. How are we going to attack just the massive uphill battle that children
face when they grow up in an impoverished neighborhood,
yes,
particularly in a neighborhood where a lot of the kids come from single parent homes, where there's crime and where there's a lack of long-term dedication and or opportunity to even think mm-hmm. about going to college. Well, the yep. Porter Billups Leadership Academy, I'd heard about it, but I didn't really understand their entire mission until I went to a fundraiser one night in a downtown hotel. And by that time, I'd gotten to know Chauncey a little bit. And going that night and seeing what they're accomplishing, the deal is this, is that if as a fifth or sixth grader, you sign up for this Porter Billups Leadership Academy and you meet their standards, that is to say, go to school, don't be truant, have good grades, and then attend our club sessions. And then every summer, it's about a month long, they have the PBLA Academy where the kids come and for an entire month learn about simple things like manners,
yes,
money management,
mm-hmm.
how to be a better student, how to say no to drugs, how not to be a single mom.
Wow.
So they learn all these things. If the child does this and has the required attendance and they follow through, by the time they become a high school senior, PBLA will give them a full ride to a university.
That is incredible.
Tuition, wow. room, and board. They've now been doing it so long that when I went to this presentation, this huge fundraiser, and it was the who's who of Denver, to see these polished kids, they're kids who have come back and are college graduates, and some of them are now teachers, businessmen, some on their way to nursing school and medical school. The secret sauce, of course, is that, yes, so much money has been raised that they can afford to actually send kids to universities coast to coast and with the local Regis University, that's the big partner in this endeavor, is that they realize, I don't know if this was the plan from the beginning, that so many of these kids are going to get full ride scholarships to other schools anyway if wow. they've overcome such amazing obstacles.
Incredible.
Going to this, and this is the answer to your specific question, for me, like most Americans, the challenge of dealing with high poverty, high mm-hmm. crime, loss of mentors, lack of mentors, it just seems like I can't help. I don't know how to make a difference. I'm sympathetic to this, but I don't know how to practically make a difference.
Yes.
Watching this PBLA, my wife and I have been so happy to partner in our practice. We have an annual golf tournament that where we turn over all the proceeds to this, to Coach Porter and to Chauncey Billups. It really is so inspiring to me. And I think this is one of the keys, is that this type of high standards and yet just really help these kids. That evening really was a life changer for me.
That's
where
incredible.
I was able to pivot and realize I could do something practical to help mm-hmm. someone that I otherwise would be kind of invisible to me.
I'm on the board of a nonprofit that their focus is to solve the food desert problem, specifically in Oklahoma. I mean, it's a problem everywhere in most states in the United States and, of course, abroad. These are these forgotten neighborhoods, these communities that do yeah. not have the infrastructure to eat healthy. They don't have the ability to grow their own food. They don't have a local grocery. They don't yep. have community gardens. None of these circumstances. So what it does is it pretty much forces their hand to eat poorly, which yes. leads to lack of education. Which,
and expensively.
Yes, which leads to expense, medical expense. It leads to deeper poverty, trapped and not being able to get out, health problems long-term, learning problems long-term, and the breadth and the depth of all the life factors that are impacted by this one core ability to have access to healthy food in your neighborhood is astounding.
It's amazing.
It blew my mind, and it really compelled me to get as involved as I could in helping empower communities by giving them the infrastructure to grow these things themselves, to have a marketplace of their own that provides jobs, that provides opportunities, and that provides healthy options. And so I'm right there with you. You know, I mean, we live lives where there are certain aspects of culture that we're blind to, that we don't see.
Right.
We assume it's difficult. We don't see the complexities of the difficulty that other people from other walks of life suffer and go through.
Right.
And whenever these moments of epiphany happen for us, it's like, it's why it's so important that people chase deeds, not words. Words are merely arguments. Deeds transform people's lives and rally other people of different walks of life to jump on board and help with that effort.
Exactly. It's, you know, one of those, you know, I know you care. Show me you care.
That's right. And in the process, learn to care more by doing, right?
And then the incredible reward for you, you know, with that, I like that food desert. That's a new phrase to me.
Yeah.
You actually get to see young people eat more healthily.
That's right.
That's amazing.
Right. And, you know, my life adage is words are walls, deeds are bridges.
Ah.
Words separate us, deeds bring us together. So always deeds, not words. All right. Well, if you have words or deeds or a question for Dr. Dave Schneider, email it or preferably send an audio recording of you asking the question to Dr. Dave Schneider at MediaFabricaStudio.com. Dr. David Schneider's latest book, The Invention of Surgery, is available wherever books are sold. I know I say that a lot. I've read this sucker. It's incredible. Regardless of your background and what you know about surgery or the medical field, it is fascinating. Pick it up. You'll love it. You'll be glad that you did. This has been Your Life Depends on It with Dr. David Schneider, a Media Fabrica podcast. All rights 2020 Media Fabrica, written, hosted, and produced by Dr. David Schneider and Mark Steele. Engineered and sound designed by Knox Studios. Original music composed and produced by Media Fabrica. Send all booking inquiries to bookings at MediaFabricaStudio.com. To follow Dr. David Schneider's weekly Three Things About Everything blog, or to find out more about Media Fabrica in general, be sure to visit us at MediaFabricaStudio.com. I am Mark Steele, and you can reach me as well at MarkSteele@MediaFabricaStudio.com. Join us next time for more of Dr. David Schneider's insights into modern advancements in medicine, health science, and the minutiae of a better life. You have the greatest opportunity in history to live well, as long as you have know-how and empowerment. That's what we are here for. After all, your life depends on it.